smuggling drugs. It escalated to bombing a loading dock within Venezuela. It included an embargo on ships to Venezuela. And finally, an invasion in which many targets were bombed. We did pull out Maduro and his wife, but that sort of that was the excuse. That wasn't the justification. And Trump made that very clear. We are running the country. We are taking its giving access to our oil companies, to its oil. This was not a law enforcement operation. It was an excuse for imperialist intervention.
And David Caldwell, you mentioned imperialist intervention. There have been similar actions by the United States in the past. Obviously, the invasion of Dominican Republic in 1965 to prevent a popular rebellion that was in the process of restoring its democratically elected president. There was also the 1983 invasion of Grenada by the Reagan administration. And interestingly, we're hearing reported by Cuba that 32 of its nationals were killed in this most recent attack. Back in 1983, more than 20 Cubans who were assisting the Grenadian government were also killed as they were resisting the U.S. Invasion. This is obviously not just a one-off of the Trump administration. This is a continuing pattern of the United States in dealing with governments that in one way or another try to exert their sovereignty or independence in contradiction to the U.S. Your thoughts?
Yeah. I mean, look, the whole world order is based on the principle, probably the first principle of international law, that countries have to respect their neighbors, and they can't simply invade a neighbor or any other sovereign nation because they don't like the way they are running things there. If Canada were to bomb U.S. Drug manufacturers because drugs are being brought across the Canadian border, we wouldn't say that's okay. If Mexico were to bomb gun manufacturers in the United States because our guns are killing thousands of Mexicans every year in Mexico, we wouldn't say that's okay. If Trump said that Biden was an illegitimate president, if Russia invaded the United States and abducted Biden to put him on trial in Russia, we wouldn't say that's okay. The whole premise of the international order is that we respect each other's borders. And when we do this, we just give a green light to Russia. Why should it stop at Ukraine? We give a green light to China. Go into Taiwan. This is really putting the world on a very, very dangerous course. And have we done it in the past? Yes. But our violating the law in the past doesn't justify violations of the law today.
And I wanted to ask you now about the status of Maduro. Clearly, he's going to appear in court today. And in terms of, but he will be entitled clearly to a defense. And what's your sense of the whole issue of whether as a sitting head of state he can be tried? What will be the issues that the judge in this case will have to deal with initially after arraignment?
Well, head of state immunity is the principal one. That will be, I think, Maduro's first argument, because the principle of head of state immunity is that one country cannot try the head of another country in their courts, not civilly, not criminally. And if anyone should, appreciate the idea of immunity, it would be President Trump, who successfully got the Supreme Court to give him immunity from prosecution even after he leaves office. This is not someone who has left office. This is someone who was in office. Whether legitimately or illegitimately is not our business, and he has head of state immunity. So that's the first and principal issue that the court will have to deal with.
Can you comment on President Trump promising to run Venezuela and seize the country's oil, saying that That's going to fund this whole operation. Let me play Trump in his own words.
The oil companies are going to go in. They're going to spend money. We're going to take back the oil that, frankly, we should have taken back a long time ago. A lot of money is coming out of the ground.
In a moment, we're going to go to Professor Miguel Tinker-Salas, who writes all about Venezuela and oil. But David Cole, the legality of this, you know, it reminds me when the U.S. invaded Iraq, George W. Bush, the jokes that were going around, a child asking his dad, what's our oil doing under their sand? The same issue here. Can you talk about what he is referring to and what it means to seize the oil, the largest oil reserves in the world?
Well, the thing about President Trump is he says the quiet part out loud. So, you know, we have been accused in many other instances of intervening in other countries because we have economic interests that we want to exploit through force. What Trump did was admit it, out and out admit that the purpose of this operation is to get their oil. That is not a law enforcement operation. That is not legitimate under any understanding of international law, of U.S. law, to go and invade another country because they have something we want. It's just not the way the world operates, or the world should operate. And, you know, the United States, again, the United States has done it in the past, but generally we have given justifications that, at least on the face of it, were far better than this one. So we went into Grenada allegedly to protect the students, our students who were in their medical schools. We went into Panama and pulled out General Manuel Noriega, but we did so only after Panama had declared war against the United States and had killed a U.S. Marine, and we had an Air Force base there and thousands of American citizens. In this instance, there's no even pretense of protecting any Americans. This is about protecting America's financial interests, and in particular, the financial interests of its oil producers. And that is just beyond the pale in terms of international law, U.S. law, basic morality.
So we just have 30 seconds. What recourse do those who are objecting to this say? If you say this is illegal, how is President Trump held to account nationally and internationally?
Well, internationally, we need widespread condemnation of this action, and I'm very disturbed by the failure of many of the European states to really speak out strongly on this. They are clearly afraid of President Trump and his economic tactics against them. But we need international condemnation by the UN Security Council, by every country who respects sovereignty. We need Congress to reject an ongoing war in Venezuela. We should not be in Venezuela, period. And so Congress can vote to end this, and should.
David Cole, we want to thank you for being with us, professor in law and public policy at Georgetown University Law Center, former ACLU National Legal Director. We'll link to your piece in the New York Review of Books. Trump's war, the invasion of Venezuela, is not law enforcement. It's imperialism, pure and simple. Go to democracynow.org. Next up, two Venezuelan-American professors, NYU's Alejandro Velasco and Pomona College's Professor Emeritus Miguel Tinker-Salas. Stay with us.
I've been thinking about talk about greed. I've been thinking about talk about greed. I've been wondering if I could sing about greed. Trying to find a way to talk about greed. Greed is a poison rising in the land. Twisted in its command, it moves like a virus, seeking out everyone. Greed never stops, and work is never ever done. A creeping, choking, killing, invading everywhere. There is really no escaping greed's sneaky snare. I've been trying to think about how to talk about greed. talk about greed.
I've been trying to think about how to
talk about greed.
I've been wondering if I could say
greed by Sweet Honey and the Rock in our Firehouse studio decades ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we talk more about the U.S. attack on Venezuela and the abduction of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, they are now, as we broadcast, being brought into the federal courthouse in New York, brought by helicopter from Brooklyn, where they have been placed in the Metropolitan Detention Center. We want to go back to President Trump speaking about Venezuela's oil on Saturday, hours after the U.S. attack.
In addition, Venezuela unilaterally seized and stole American oil, American assets, and American platforms, costing us billions and billions of dollars. They did this a while ago, but we never had a president that did anything about it. They took all of our property. It was our property. We built it. And we never had a president that decided to do anything about it. Instead, they fought wars that were 10,000 miles away. We built Venezuela oil industry with American talent, drive, and skill. And the socialist regime stole it from us during those previous administrations. And they stole it through force. This constituted one of the largest thefts of American property in the history of our country. Considered the largest theft of property in the history of our country. Massive oil infrastructure was taken like we were babies, so we didn't do anything about it. I would have done something about it.
That's President Trump talking about the theft of Venezuelan oil, talking about it as our oil. We're joined by two guests in our New York studio, Alejandro Velasco, associate professor at New York University, where he's historian of modern Latin America, former executive editor of NACLA Report on the Americas, author of the book Barrio Rising, Urban Popular Politics and the Making of Modern Venezuela. He was born and raised in Venezuela. And Mikhail Tinker Salas is with us, emeritus professor of history at Pomona College in Claremont, California, author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture and Society in Venezuela, and the book Venezuela, What Everyone Needs to Know. Welcome back, both of you, to Democracy Now! Professor Miguel Tinker Salas, oil is what you've been covering in Venezuela for decades. Talk about Trump's comments that it's Venezuela's oil that will fund the U.S. running Venezuela.
Well, we heard this with Bush in the Iraq invasion, that the oil from Iraq was going to finance the intervention and the long-term rebuilding. The reality is that that failed in Iraq, and it will fail in Venezuela. Venezuela's oil industry has taken a hit in the last 15 years. It is a semblance of what it used to be. And the reality is I cannot imagine any American oil company going into Venezuela, spending billions of dollars to build up an infrastructure without American boots on the ground or without very clear guarantees. And even if they did, the process would take close to a decade. So Trump is talking the same way he always does. It is an exaggeration. It is an outright lie. And I believe it to be simply another pretext, another excuse to try to convince the American public that what he did had any value.
And Miguel Tinker Salas, I wanted to ask you again something that we discussed on Saturday in our special report on the Venezuela invasion. This whole notion of Trump, the lie that he keeps foisting on the American public, that it was the socialist government of Venezuela that took this oil, when in reality the nationalization of Venezuela's oil industry occurred long before anyone had heard of Hugo Chavez and the Bolivarian Revolution. Could you talk about that history as well?
Sure. Venezuela was Venezuelans were always keen on gaining control over its own oil industry. Without a doubt, American and Europeans were present at the beginning of the oil industry, but the actual work was done by Venezuelans. The actual establishment of the industry was done by Venezuelans. And there was always an aspiration that that oil industry would belong to the country and the country could benefit from that more than simply providing concessions to foreign oil companies. So the nationalization happened in 1975. It was a fully compensated nationalization taking effect on January 1st, 1976, and it was done under the government of Carlos Andrés Pérez, a social democratic government, not Hugo Chávez. Chávez did do close the door to openings that were there for American foreign companies in Article 5 of the reform. And in 2007, there was a clash with ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips over oil deposits in the Orinoco Basin. Exxon demanded $16 billion. A court decided that they only owed $1.6 billion. So you can see from the very beginning that the process of nationalization had been compensated and negotiated. So there was no taking of quote unquote American property or American oil. It was Venezuelan oil. It belonged to Venezuela. And it was the purview of the Venezuelan government to decide who or what operated those oil fields.
And Miguel, I also wanted to ask you about other resources that have not been mentioned, but that clearly American capitalists are salivating over the prospects of getting access to. One is coltan, a rare metal that is in most laptop computers and phones and has uses for the military, as well as diamonds and gold. You talk about the immense resources that Venezuela has in these other areas.
Oil is only on the surface. The reality is, as you point out, Venezuela is rich in gold. It's rich in rare earths, rare minerals. It is rich in gas, one of the largest deposits of gas in the world. It is rich in lithium. It has potential for tremendous lithium. It has coal. It has other minerals as well. So that the positioning of the U.S. as a investor in Venezuela or as a corporate interest in Venezuela is massive. It involves not only the country's strategic position and is the interface between the Caribbean and South America, but it involves the possession of tremendous mineral deposits and oil deposits. It reminds me of what the American general in charge of the Caribbean during World War II said, if of all the countries of Latin America, I only want one ally, and that is Venezuela, because they're beautifully rich in oil and minerals. That has been the position of the U.S. government since 1940 and to the present.
I'd also like to bring in a professor, NYU professor Alejandro Velasco, into the conversation. Professor Velasco, on Saturday evening, you posted on social media that it seemed as if, quote, Maduro was given up by the remaining government apparatus in a back channel deal. Do you still think that? And what would that mean? And do you believe that Delcy Rodriguez, who is now will be now sworn in as interim president, was herself complicit in this operation?
Obviously, it's somewhat speculative, but clues point in some kind of direction that suggests that might be the case. One of the things that we do know is that months leading up to, of course, the abduction of Nicolás Maduro and people like Delcy Rodriguez, Jorge Rodriguez, and others.
Explain Jorge Rodriguez, her brother.
Yeah, Jorge Rodriguez is Delcy's brother. Both of them.
He's head of the National Assembly.
He is head of the National Assembly, but has held many posts under Chávez. Government and then under Maduro's government for years. Both of them have a long story tradition of leftist politics in Latin America, in Venezuela in particular. Their father was a Marxist guerrilla who was assassinated under the government in the 1970s and were closely allied with the United States. And they've really cemented a position in government as being right-hand people to Maduro, for sure, but Chávez before him. But what we had seen in the months leading up to the abduction was that Maduro and these inner circle members had been negotiating with the Trump administration things like oil deals, things like other kinds of investment from the United States. But the missing piece there seemed to be whether Maduro would remain in power. Given how quickly the operation unfolded on Saturday and how quickly it seems that Delcy Rodriguez has been able to consolidate power over the intervening 48 hours, you have to assume that there was some kind of collusion or at least some kind of conversation happening between the parties beforehand. Maduro in exchange for remaining in power, Maduro in exchange for stability, Maduro in exchange for some kind of open dealing with the United States. Now, of course, the challenge for Delcy and others is, can they straddle this line between doing in some ways Trump's bidding and then at the same time maintaining, as Andreina Chavez was saying earlier, a position of sovereignty and mutual respect of bilateral relations between Venezuela and the United States. I don't know if they'll be able to do it.
And Alejandro,
go ahead, Juan.
Alejandro, I wanted to ask you also in terms of the ability of Venezuela to maneuver through this situation right now. You have also raised the issue that Cuba is also in the focus of the United States in terms of what it's doing in Venezuela. Could you talk about that as well?
I have long maintained, and this isn't secret to anyone, that Marco Rubio's primary interest in the region is not Venezuela, it's not Colombia, it's not Mexico, it's Cuba. As a Cuban-American and long stridently an opponent of the Castro government and, of course, now the current government in Cuba, he's made no secret of his desire to oust the government in Cuba. The problem, of course, for him is that Cuba has no resources that Trump would be interested in, and so he would have to sell Trump only on the basis of ideology. We have to, kill a leftist government. And he now sees an opening with Venezuela. He's now able to say, look, if we can deliver resources from Venezuela through a low-level, deadly, of course, but low-level engagement, we can do something similar in Cuba and at the same time deliver not just Cuba and Venezuela, but the rest of the hemisphere to a Trumpist vision of the world. That is my sense of what is largely at stake here.
So you have Marco Rubio, hours after the bombing of Venezuela and the abduction of President Maduro and his wife, speaking in the news conference with Trump, saying basically, Cuba better watch out. And then on Sunday, you have President Trump speaking on Air Force One.
Cuba is ready to fall,
Yes.
Cuba looks like it's ready to fall. I don't know if they're going to hold out.
Is there a final
but
straw?
Cuba now has no income. They got all of their income from Venezuela, from the Venezuelan oil. They're not getting any of it. And Cuba literally is ready to fall. And you have a lot of great Cuban Americans that are going to be very happy about this.
And then you have President Trump also threatening the Colombian president, Gustavo Petro.
Colombia is very sick, too, run by a sick man who likes making cocaine and selling it to the United States. And he's not going to be doing it very long, let me tell you.
What does that mean? He's not going to be doing it very long.
He's not doing it very long. He has cocaine mills and cocaine factories. He's not going to be doing it very long.
So there will be an operation by the U.S. in
Colombia? It sounds good to me.
So in a lengthy series of lengthy posts on X, I think it was like 700 words, Colombian President Petro blasted Trump, saying, quote, "Stop slandering me, Mr. Trump." Petro called on Latin America to unite against the U.S., saying the region risks being, quote, "treated as a servant and slave." So go from Cuba to Colombia and what this means.
Well, certainly in the case of Cuba, what President Trump said is accurate insofar as most of the revenue that Cuba had been getting over the past 5, 10, 15 years was coming through the subvention of Venezuelan oil. And of course, if they closed that small spigot that had been a lifeline of Cuba, then Cuba's position is incrementally worse. And you might end up seeing protests that we've seen prior years, and as a result, then a kind of pretext for intervention. But then if you link that in what Cuba represents to Latin America, which is a kind of paragon of a different different alternative for Latin America as a region, a leftist alternative, with all of its faults that we can, of course, talk about at length. Losing that for the region would then open up the door for other countries and other right-wing countries in Latin America or right-wing movements in Latin America to say, now we have a White House in power and no Cuba in present in the region, or leftist government in the region, to be able to do what we want. And so to me, this is far, far larger an ideological project and battle that's being waged with Venezuela as a kind of instrumental piece.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Miguel Tinker Salas back into the conversation, and this whole issue of Trump focusing not just on Venezuela, but also on Cuba, Colombia, and how Latin America you expect will respond, because clearly this is not the same Latin America, as I said repeatedly, that existed 50 years ago or 60 years ago. There's many more popular movements, stronger progressive leaders in several countries. What's your sense of how the region is going to respond in the coming weeks and months?
Well, I think there's a difference between how political leaders may respond, because obviously someone like Milei or Noboa or Bukele will respond in support of Trump. It's another thing how the population of Latin America will respond. And I think that's the big difference here, because as you point out, there has been a tremendous level of mobilization of social consciousness that has occurred. But there's also been the weight of the crisis that has affected many countries in Latin America and left mistakes that have been made in many cases in many countries in their inability to deliver. But I think we're also overestimating U.S. empire, because what we saw in Venezuela on Saturday the 3rd was the spectacle of empire. It was the promotion of empire while not actually landing troops on the ground. They were unable to do that because they know that that would bog them down in a long-term war. And taking on Cuba at the same time, and taking on Iran at the same time, and taking on bombings Nigeria at the same time, and potentially conflicts in Ukraine and in Asia and Taiwan, etc. I think we should not overestimate the role of the U.S. empire. I think the military in the U.S. would push back to any kind of operation in other countries, because that would be a long-term commitment, because taking Cuba means implying the same old Colin Powell doctrine, the Pottery Barn doctrine, that was, if you break it, you own it. So if the U.S. expects to have run Venezuela, they're also going to have to run Cuba, and they're also going to have to run Colombia, and they're also going to expect, I doubt that the U.S. military is prepared for that kind of long-term engagement. That doesn't mean that I don't believe that the U.S. wants to remake Latin America the same way that the neocons wanted to remake the Middle East. The current administration under Marco Rubio really wants to remake Latin America. They want it to be the American pond. They want it to be the Caribbean that they control. They want it to go back to Teddy Roosevelt and guns and bolt diplomacy and big stick diplomacy and control the region. But again, we shouldn't overestimate the role of U.S. empire. I think we saw on Saturday was the spectacle of empire.
I mean, I completely agree with Miguel, and that last point that he made is so central. I think what we're seeing here is a return to this gunboat diplomacy that had been the hallmark of the Teddy Roosevelt period in the early 20th century.
I want to ask you, Alejandro, very quickly about President Trump responding to a reporter about the Venezuelan opposition leader, Nobel Prize laureate Maria Corina Machado.
Oh, I think it would be very tough for her to be the leader. She doesn't have the support within or the respect within the country. She's a very nice woman, but she doesn't have the respect.
I think many people were shocked that President Trump threw Maria Corina Machado under the bus, the woman who basically dedicated her Peace Prize and said that Trump should have gotten that Peace Prize. Where does this leave her? And also talk about the wife of exactly who President Maduro's wife, Celia Flores, is. She is a key political figure herself.
For sure. I mean, let's start with Maria Corina Machado.
And we have 30 seconds.
No one could have been more surprised as she was sidelined, not just at the press conference, but then doubled down yesterday. Marco Rubio also saying that she's not ready, you know, to stand in. I think what Machado overestimated was the degree to which Trump wanted democracy. He doesn't want democracy. He just wants oil, right? And so in that sense, you know, it was unsurprising that she would be sidelined. to anyone but her.
Celia Flores, 10 seconds.
Celia Flores, long story career under Chavez, was the head of the National Assembly, significant degree of political power. We'll see what emerges from this trial.
And we're going to talk more about this in these coming days. And also remember that President Trump just pardoned the convicted narco-trafficker, Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain.
No matter your disability, you likely face barriers in your everyday life. At Neil Squire, we help break those barriers down by helping you access employment, technology, and the tools you need to live your life to the fullest. As a nonprofit organization, we empower people with disabilities all across Canada, and we are here for you too. Visit neilsquire.ca to learn more.